We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's good to have you back. No Maria today.
Thank you.
She apparently had a business-related emergency, so she's hoping...
As opposed to my landing in the hospital last week. But I'm doing better now, so that's good.
That's good. So as long as one of you remains...
Yeah, we hand it off.
We will slog on.
Yep.
So, very busy week, starting out with local and more stuff revolving around the Seattle Police Department and last week's, well, going back to this last summer. So, start out with multiple SPD officers.
Interim Chief Diaz had a press conference earlier this week at which he said several SPD officers, the previous reports had been two, so it sounds like there were more, but we don't know, and we don't have any details, that several SPD officers participated in the attempted coup at the U.S. Capitol last week on January 6th. The peers turned them in, which is interesting. And of course, it being SPD, they're on paid administrative leave, which is to say a paid vacation, which is kind of appalling since you do take an oath to protect the Constitution when you're sworn as an officer. It's more of SPD's, basically coddling of misbehaving officers. The city council has asked for the resignation of Seattle Police Officers Guild head Mike Dolan for his comments.
Solon.
I keep wanting to say Dolan, but it's Solon. You're correct. Resignation for he claimed Antifa was behind January 6th, and we'll get into some of the reasons for that in a little bit. Scott Lindsay. Endorsed that call. He's the city attorney, Chief Diaz demurred. He didn't want to say anything. He said it's his job to run the union. It's my job to run SPD, and he kept saying it's my job to run SPD, which is kind of a clue that that it's really Solon who runs SPD. So that happened, and then. The OPA released a report yesterday, which was highly critical of SPD's use of force during BLM protests last summer. Here's some of the quotes from it. Seattle police used improper force when officers separately hurled a tear gas canister at a TV news crew and blast balls that injured two people during demonstrations down Capitol Hill last June. That was one of OPA's quotes. Another one, an officer in riot gear standing in a police line near the department's East Precinct seized a protester's pink umbrella, sparking an eruption of tear gas, flashbang devices, and pepper spray that sent scores of protesters running for cover. A police commander and other officers overstepped their authority. Again, that's OPA. And then they cleared two bicycle officers who were captured on video punching one demonstrator and using a restraint hold on another while making arrests. I'm not sure why they cleared them, but that seemed pretty straightforward. Officers acted according to policy but recommended the department amend its guidelines so as not to escalate potentially volatile situations. And of course, criticism of the department's use of force policies has been kind of standard for the last several months. They're vague and leave a lot to the discretion of the on-scene commanders. And OPA had literally over 10,000 complaints on the course of those demonstrations for the last several months. And that resolved some of them. There's a ticking clock because of the OPA contract. They have to resolve them within 90 days. And I don't know how many more they will get to, honestly, because that takes us through September. I'm sure there have been plenty of additional complaints since then. But we'll have to see how many more they get to. Yeah, and I've got a little bit more on OPA in a bit here. Excuse me, on SPD.
So the push for criticism of Mike Solon is, in addition to Scott Lindsay, I thought he was a former attorney under I mean, he still might be an attorney, but I thought he, at least in terms of representing the city of Seattle, that he worked for. Oh, no.
He used to be, you're right. He used to be under Pete Holmes, ran against him in the last election and was not successful. Right.
So his,
I keep thinking Pete Holmes is retired and he hasn't. Sorry, Pete.
So I kind of had the feel when his criticism came out, which was a decent criticism. You kind of had that feel, since there's people who are now throwing their hat in the ring for different offices, that would be a good warm-up act for someone who was about to run for office.
Yeah, particularly since he ran against Pete Holmes from the right as being more pro-police. So it was interesting that he came out with that. But it did kind of smack of ambition. You're right. Mm-hmm.
And then Carmen Best jumped on his
feet. Yes, that's right. That was the other one. I was trying to think of who the other person was.
And then finally, I'm not sure time-wise, when Jenny Durkin's criticism and public comment came down, that came later in the week, where she's ended it with, he either needs to apologize or resign for what he's been saying. Which
I did not see that. It's interesting that there's no love lost between the Durkin and Solon.
So, but it sounds like Mike Solon has been resolute in not backing down on anything that he said.
No, he never backs down on anything he says, unfortunately. And, you know, there's a history of this kind of thing with him. It's not just that one comment.
Right.
It was just kind of a breaking point for a lot of people.
Anything else on the Seattle Police Department before we
move on? Well, we'll get back to that when we start with National.
Okay.
I'll tease there.
All right. Well, then let's move on to Olympia, which is open for business this week.
Yeah. Olympia started its state legislative session on Monday with hearings on various bills. It's also kind of a fortress after repeated right-wing protests there. There were National Guard on standby, and there's fencing all around the Capitol complex due to threats of right-wing protests at the opening of the legislative session. It turned out only about 20 patriots, quote-unquote, showed up in Olympia on Monday. Of course, they're still concerned because this week and into the inauguration next week, there have been threats of right-wing protests at state capitals across the country. And Olympia is not the only place that is battened down and bracing itself for protests. And I'll get into that when we talk about the national situation. But there are Washington National Guard that are serving, that are protecting the state capitol, as well as a lot of police. And fencing around the complex. It's kind of a disconcerting situation. The legislature only met in person on Monday and only long enough to pass a change in the rules that allows them to meet online again this session. And then they've been having hearings online this week. And there are a number of bills they are considering that are of interest. For instance, the carbon tax that Jay Inslee has been pushing for a number of sessions now is back again this year, as well as changes in the capital gains tax to try and raise more revenue for the state. There is a police accountability bill that would separate accountability measures and administrative the ability to disciplinary, that's what I'm looking for, disciplinary measures from the rest of contract negotiations. That, of course, would be a huge change and kind of a dangerous precedent for government employees overall. So I would think that some of those unions, like, for instance, teachers unions, would have a lot of concerns about that. And I don't know that it'll get very far, that particular one. But there's a lot of different bills that have had hearings this week. That was one of them. The capital gains was another. The carbon tax was another. And we'll just have to keep an eye on some of those different measures as they get introduced and have their first hearings and, walk through the legislative process. Of course, it's several steps before they become a law.
Yeah, from my readings on the police accountability bills and relating to contract negotiations, it appears that the Seattle labor representatives are supportive of the bills, whereas the rest of Washington State, for instance, the Washington State Labor Council appears opposed to those changes. So it's looking kind of like Seattle King County thinking versus the greater state of Washington.
Right.
Which is, we run into regularly.
Yes.
State of Washington.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, labor has been mixed on it so far.
Yeah. It's always interesting to see how labor comes down on different issues.
Yeah.
Both, regionally.
Yeah, when I saw that the King County Labor Council was supportive of it, I was thinking, wow, they're really angry with SPD, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, and they were the ones to kick the police guilds out of the King County Labor Council, correct?
Yes, that was last summer.
Yeah. So.
I believe it was in June. Yep.
All right. So, should have a lot coming out of Olympia for this coming session.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on, the spotted owl is back in the news.
Yes. A spotted owl is kind of a news junkie. It had its 15 minutes in the 90s, and it's having another 15 minutes now. One of the many actions that the Trump administration is taking on its way out the door to gut regulations and that kind of thing, and reward its friends in various industries. And we got an announcement early this week that kind of got buried in the news that it was removing protections for the spotted owl habitat from some 3 million acres in the Pacific Northwest. That's 15 times, that reduces the protected habitat for the spotted owl by a factor of 15 and opens up all the rest of those, areas. Many of them in like the Olympic Peninsula and Western Washington, to timber or other resource extraction industries. Now it's unclear how long that can last because of course the incoming Biden administration can simply, undo that particular deregulation next week. And hopefully they will. And hopefully our state senators, Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, are paying attention and can let their old Senate buddy Joe and Kamala for that matter, know about this and make sure that gets undone. Because if they don't, I'm sure it will wind up in court. I kind of doubt that's going to be implemented, but it was an alarming gesture. It's like, really? Where'd you pull that up from? So, I'm sure, some of our very talented local environmental lawyers are lining up the lawsuits on that one.
Yeah, as if there was some big rush to extract what, remaining trees we have and, resources that are nearby,
Yeah, well.
As if climate change wasn't occurring. And
Yeah, exactly.
All right. And finally on, well, not finally, but also on local, the local Black Lives Matter Seattle King County had several press releases this week, but one that really caught our eye related to the FBI and disinformation.
Yeah, and this is another local story that kind of got buried in all the things that have been going on this week. BLM, Seattle King County, is alleging that the FBI was responsible for disinformation that was given to SPD and the city of Seattle last summer. That information on a potential threat from Antifa that led to the abandonment of the East Precinct last June. And that, of course, led to CHOP and CHAZ and the anarchist jurisdiction labeled by the same federal government. This was basically that the city of Seattle was told there was a credible threat to that building. And that led to the city abandoning the building for about 3 weeks. And of course, in its absence, protesters took that as a victory, established a permanent, basically anarchist encampment. And there was a big brouhaha when the city retook the space 3 weeks later. Now that raises several questions. For one, who in the Department of Justice was responsible for that disinformation? This is true. Who in the Department of Justice was responsible for that disinformation? Why they gave that kind of disinformation? And then why was the city not transparent in saying what the threat was? Jenny Durkin made a couple of oblique references to it, as did Carmen Best at the time. But it was never really followed up on, and local media never really followed up on it either. It's interesting. I would love to know what BLM, Seattle King County sources are for that. They won't tell me, I ask. But if true, that's a very, very interesting allegation, and, says once again that the Trump administration was a little more than a passive bystander in its responses to the racial justice, demonstrations around the country last summer. I guess another question is, why Seattle? There were plenty of other, cities at the time that before the establishment of CHOP that were more in the public eye at the time. But, you know, once CHOP was established, it became a fixture of right-wing fear-mongering on places like Fox News and Breitbart, et cetera. Seattle got a lot of negative attention from right-wing media then, and that's how we wound up on the anarchist jurisdiction list.
Well, it wouldn't be hard to believe that actually, again, since the details are scant, that multiple cities could have gotten warnings like that. Just as Seattle did, and also not hard to believe that it might have potentially come through the fusion centers that share their information with all the other fusion centers and are made up of numerous quote-unquote law enforcement groups, as well as military, as well as private, security firms that frequently, grab stuff from internet sites and then use that verbatim in their reports that get distributed to the fusion centers that then get distributed to local police departments. So,
yeah, my first thought was the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. Mm-hmm. That are established at FBI offices around the country. And of course, we have an FBI office in Western Washington that's here in Seattle.
Yeah.
It could have originated at that level. It could have originated at a higher level. We just don't know. As you say, details are not very not very known at this point.
Yeah. So that seems like something we'll hopefully be finding out some more details on as time goes by.
Yeah, I think we're going to once the Biden people are in place, I think we're going to find out a lot of stuff that was done that was unsavory under Trump. And that could be one of them, certainly. Yeah. And again, I'm sure the purpose of the BLM SKC release was to, sick some resourceful reporters on it and some FOIA requests and things like that. And we may get some more details coming soon.
Yes, as the incoming Biden administration will inevitably have some savvier PR people that will be presenting a much more savory interpretation.
Yeah. They'll have their own scandals, but they'll be presented a little more a little bit less ham-fistedly.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on then to the numerous COVID updates that have been occurring.
Yeah, here's the happy news portion of our broadcast. Now, COVID is still with us. It really doesn't care about our domestic political turmoil, and we're past 70,000 confirmed cases now in King County. We'll start out with local and then go to national and global. We got a Portland area patient yesterday in Multnomah County, became the first known person in the Pacific Northwest to contract a more contagious British variant of the virus, SARS-CoV-2. So, that is with us. The CDC estimated this week that would be the dominant form of SARS-CoV-2, which is a virus that causes COVID-19, by mid-March. So it's coming. It's probably already here, and now is not the time to relax. Keep doing the hand washing. Keep doing the social distancing. Stay at home when you can, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's good that people are getting vaccinated, and Washington State is expected to change its vaccination guidelines soon. HHS Secretary Alex Azar on Tuesday changed the guidelines that the CDC has been issuing for who should get the vaccine. He wants states to change their guidelines, rather, so that people over the age of 65 and people with underlying conditions get immediate priority. That's a major change. And given that the state of Washington only last week had launched a new system of 8 regions and only 2 phases, phase 1 and phase 2, for their prioritization of who should get the vaccine when, that was based on the previous CDC guidelines. Those have changed. And some counties are now actually changing. We saw Clallam County yesterday, for example, start administering the vaccine to anybody over the age of 70. Stevens County in eastern Washington has apparently changed its guidelines as well. But the state has not issued new guidelines yet. They're still on the 8 region system that, they spent weeks and weeks developing that. So I expect that they'll issue new guidelines soon, sometime in the next week or two.
Okay, before you go on, can I ask a couple questions?
Sure.
Do you interpret the changes that were proposed or instituted on Tuesday, are those good changes?
It certainly makes more people eligible for vaccine, and the sooner more people get vaccinated, the better. So, yes, I would say so. I had a healthcare provider on Thursday tell me that I'd be eligible for vaccine in 2 to 3 weeks was her words. And I'm not 65, but I do have multiple underlying conditions, as long-time listeners I'm sure are aware. So that was good news, and it's a sign that at the ground level, people are preparing for those changes, even if the guidelines have not changed with the state yet. So the faster that the vaccine can get into people's arms, the better. Absolutely. We had Joe Biden issue a national vaccination plan, which I'll get to in a minute here when I get to national. Let's go to Washington. Let's go to national. And the national COVID news, there was news related to January 6th as well. Local Congresswoman Premi Jayapal tested positive for COVID-19 this week. So did 3 other Democratic representatives, Bonnie Coleman Watson of New Jersey, Brad Schneider of Illinois, and Adriano Espelot, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, from New York City. Watson Coleman is particularly notable. She's 75 years old. She has survived cancer, and so she's particularly vulnerable to the virus. Espalat, incidentally, the New York City rep, was the first formerly undocumented immigrant to ever be elected to Congress. He's Dominican, from the Dominican Republic. So, you know, some notable people, and all of them are blaming the fact that they were locked in a secure location with maskless Republicans who turned out to test positive for COVID-19. Jayapal in particular has been quite outspoken about that. We mentioned that the guidance that Azar changed to over 65 and underlying conditions. A big story that came out yesterday was, you may remember last week when it was early this week when the Trump administration gave in to calls they had been holding back a stockpile of vaccine for second doses. Well, of course, some people are getting to the point where they're receiving their second doses now. But more than that, the case was made that since even one dose of both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine offer protection, that the government should be shipping all of its vaccine to states, and then the companies are making more vaccine in real time, and they will have enough for second doses in a month. It turns out that there was no stockpile to ship to the states after they announced that they would early in the week. And that raises the question, it never existed. Was that incompetence? Jared sell the stockpile to the Saudis, or what happened there? We don't know. But we do know that the federal government has no reserve of vaccine at this point. At least that's what they're claiming. It will be hard to trust anything that the federal government says, honestly, until the Biden people are in place.
Doesn't that also connect to back on mid-December, when the first doses were being distributed and all the footage that the media was showing us, the daily, here's a picture. I mean, that is really popular on social media. Like, here's a picture of me getting, the vaccine.
Sure.
But that was when multiple states.
You've seen one needle going into an arm. You've seen most of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was about the same time that multiple states, including Washington State, were basically saying, oh gosh, it turns out 40% is being held back for quality control reasons or whatever. Meanwhile, the vaccine companies were saying, no, we're shipping everything that, we were supposed to ship. And I mean, it just reeked of something is horribly wrong in what you've been telling us.
Yeah. And it turns out that, the vaccine companies had the reserves because they were following the federal government's instructions as to what to ship. So that reserve did exist at that time. So what happened to it?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah.
We have no idea.
But clearly it seems probable that someone is getting very rich off.
It does. And, given that it's being distributed by the most corrupt administration in American history, my suspicions would start there, but who knows?
Yeah. Hopefully, more will be coming soon.
Yeah.
More information as well as
yes.
Vaccine.
So, of course, Nero has been completely absent from the conversation of how to respond to the pandemic, ever since he, won the election in a landslide. Excuse me, lost the election. He's been pouting ever since, and not really doing anything resembling his job. But we did get some presidential leadership from the president-elect this week. On Thursday, Biden released a fairly detailed plan for how he wants to respond to the pandemic and the economic downturn that has resulted from it. To start with, this is a plan that he will send, by and large, send to Congress, although some of it is administrative and he can do it himself. He wants Congress to approve another $1,400 stimulus to go with a $600 that a lot of people have already received this month. This is a $1.9 trillion plan. He wants $350 million of that to go to local governments to help with the budget shortfalls that a lot of states and local jurisdictions have had as a result of the pandemic. There will be $20 billion to help with vaccine development and rollout. I'll talk more about that in a minute. He wants to establish community health centers across the country, especially in rural areas, so that because one of the problems with the country's response to the pandemic has been the loss of hospitals in rural areas especially over the last decade. A lot of hospitals have closed. So he wants to establish those. And this is part of economic stimulus as well. He wants to establish 100,000 jobs administering vaccine and doing contract tracing, which is a very labor-intensive effort that most states have not been able to afford in any real way. And, of course, you know, the community spread has been so widespread that contract tracing has been virtually impossible in a lot of COVID-19 cases. It's most useful at the beginning of a pandemic. And the interesting thing about that is it also establishes an infrastructure for response to future emergencies, which we're likely to have in the coming decades with climate change especially. There's been some criticism of that portion of the plan for its lack of detail and how they would coordinate with state health departments, but you would assume that people are working on that. They got three more days before the inauguration, so plenty of time. But they do have a large team that's working on that plan already. And the same thing for the vaccine rollout, which Biden released a plan for on Friday. And it's interesting that it's not just vaccine rollout, but it's also, researching how to treat COVID-19. The treatment has improved quite a bit with the more that we've learned about the virus. I should say viruses it now. I'll talk about that in a second. But the mortality rate has dropped quite a bit from where it was last spring. You can tell that because New York State still has the most deaths of any state, although California is trying to catch up at the moment. New York passed 40,000 this week. California passed 30,000. But the vaccine distribution plan it was very interesting. The best news of it has been the naming of Dr. David Kessler to head the effort. You may remember that name. Kessler is the former head of the FDA in the 1990s who oversaw the development and distribution of protease inhibitors, which was the drug cocktail that basically turned AIDS and HIV from a death sentence into a treatable disease. He has saved a lot of lives in the past, and the hope is that he will again now. He'll be in charge both of the research in how to treat COVID-19 and also vaccine distribution. And he was in the media saying a lot of positive things this week about Biden's plan and what he would like to do and the sheer scale of the effort. Biden wants to see 100 million people vaccinated in 100 days. I talked about those community health centers. He wants to establish those as a way to get vaccine into people's arms in every community, large and small. He wants to mobilize FEMA and the National Guard to staff a lot of those centers initially. And he wants to establish mass vaccination centers in urban areas. And we've seen some of that already this week and last week with the establishment of mass vaccination centers in Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles, in the Padres Stadium in San Diego, and in the Mets and Yankees stadiums in New York City. So some of that's already happening at the state level. Biden's projecting doing that not just in every city that has a Major League Baseball team, but in all large cities, finding you know, places. And this is similar to the field hospitals that we saw, especially last spring, but are also seeing now in Southern California. So that's a very ambitious plan, and it's a very specific plan, which is a sort of thing that has simply not happened under the Trump administration. It's an encouraging sign to see the federal government mobilizing under Biden at a scale that would have been appropriate, especially, you know, 9-10 months ago, but has been absolutely missing ever since they punted to the states, which has been very much a mixed bag, a patchwork, particularly since you had a lot of Republican governors who didn't take the pandemic seriously, and who, therefore, because early on it was a problem in Seattle, New York City, Detroit, New Orleans, Chicago, you know, urban areas. So the Trump administration treated it as, well, that's a Democrat problem. And we've seen how many people have died since then. Nearly 400,000. We're up over 390 now. We'll probably reach 400,000 by the end of the weekend. So, that was encouraging. More discouraging is some of the world news that happened, which of course we are not paying much attention to because we're so domestically focused in the United States right now. The world passed 90 million confirmed cases this week, and it probably last night passed 2 million dead, which is a staggering toll if you think about it. And in the last 2 weeks, a number of different variants have emerged. Of course, we knew about the British variant, which is more contagious, and we've been seeing those that take over, really, the UK in terms of its cases. And as I said, the CDC expects that it will be dominant in the United States by, the middle of March. And we had our first case in the Pacific Northwest this week. The South African variant, which also has been known since the last month, appears to be not only more contagious, similar to the UK variant, but also has some resistance to vaccines. And the scientific reports on that have been mixed so far. France has announced a variant. And then Japan announced a variant early this month that came from 4 people traveling from Brazil. Well, it turns out Brazil has 2 different variants, and they're both bad news, but one is particularly bad news because it's not only more contagious, similar to the UK variant, but it also appears to be able to neutralize SARS-CoV-2 antibodies, which, of course, is the technology that most of the vaccines that have been approved or are under development is based upon. So it may be resistant to vaccines as well. For that reason, Brazil cut off all travel from, I'm sorry, the UK travel cut off all travel from Latin America this week, as well as Portugal, which of course has a lot of ties to Brazil. For that reason, they're terrified that the Brazilian variant might show up in Europe. So that was the sobering news this week. Of course, it's all sobering news at this point, except for the vaccine distribution, which hopefully will be escalating in the next couple of weeks.
So in terms of the UK variant, do the current tests that we, those who have done the tests, do here locally, do those pick up the things like the UK variant and the other variants, or do they have to do additional testing for that?
No, it's a variant, but it's still the same virus. It just has like different receptors have mutated. But yes, the test will pick it up. The problem runs more in how transmissible they are. It's the same things that prevent the spread of the original variant, which is social distancing, hand washing, masks when you're out in public, et cetera, et cetera. We know what prevents the spread. it's just very difficult getting a critical mass, you know, 90%+ of the public to adhere to those regulations. And, you know, nobody adheres 100% of the time, but, you know, the more of it you can do, the more of the time, just turn it into a habit. You know, every time I leave the house, I'm wearing a mask. You know, I'm staying away from people. I'm not hugging my friends, even though I trust them. And, you know, if they, I'm sure they take all the precautions. No, they don't. Nobody does all the time. And you can't, you can't do it all the time. Nobody's perfect. But, you know, the more of the time you do it, the better the odds are, and the less the virus has a chance to spread. It's just basic public health. And the other problem is that, you know, public health departments and health departments, both at the state and county and city and municipality levels, have been bled for funding for decades. They're one of the first places that get cut because, you know, they basically exist to anticipate emergencies. You know, that's why they, in King County, for example, that's why they monitor restaurants. They're not monitoring restaurants for, routine issues. They're monitoring restaurants for spreading disease or not spreading disease, et cetera. And, you know, when you starve federal agencies or government agencies of that kind of funding, they don't have the resources available to respond to emergencies. And we've seen that at every level. I mean, the state and King County health departments have done an amazing job of responding to the pandemic. With, you know, people have been working 80-hour weeks for a year now. They don't have the resources that they need, but they've done, really done a very good job. So a shout out to those folks. But, you know, that has been a chronic problem at every level in every state, and federally as well. The CDC, National Institutes of Health, et cetera, have also had a lot of funding cuts over the last 20 years.
Right. And of course, the health departments are dependent. Their tools are, you know, local hospitals, and those are, you know, for profit businesses that continue to cut back on all the stuff that we as a society need, and instead take that money and put it into a select number of people's pockets.
Yeah, and that has also been a problem with the pandemic response. It's two separate problems. I mentioned earlier that hospitals have been closing in rural areas, and those are cost-cutting measures. You know, rural hospitals serving maybe a catchment area of 100,000 people or 50,000 people just aren't as profitable. You know, those are closed, and we'll send you to the nearest hospital 70 miles away. Well, that's a problem when you've got a pandemic. The other issue is staffing, and we've seen, you know, nurses as one example that have really taken on more and more patients per nurse in recent years as big corporate hospitals streamline and cut costs. You know, they work odd shifts. They're not consistent over the course of a week. You know, they're not full time, so they don't get paid benefits. And that's been a real problem that we've seen with, turnover in the industry, as nurses get exhausted, as they've been working insane hours, in the course of the pandemic and, you know, the emotional tear that it takes to watch people die every day. We've seen a shortage as, nurses can't keep up. They're exhausted over the course of month after month of huge workloads with the number of patients coming in. And we've seen this in state after state after state, and that also is a function of what you're talking about, that, you know, leaving hospitals as for-profit institutions, either functionally, as because they're incorporated as nonprofits, but they act exactly like corporate for-profit hospitals, or they actually are for-profit hospitals. either way. The major hospitals in medium and large size cities, and that includes Virginia Mason, Swedish, and UW here. UW has a huge reserve, and their medical centers are extremely profitable, but and keep expanding. But you know, technically it's a nonprofit, but they operate like a for-profit in many ways, and the same is true, I believe, of Virginia Mason and Swedish. That model has been a serious problem in responding to the pandemic. There's a lot of turnover in the profession.
Yeah.
Up to and including doctors, have to work ridiculously long and stressful shifts in the course of the pandemic. They burn out.
Yeah, and that was happening
or they get sick
before the pandemic. You know, so. Yeah.
Yeah, I think something like 2,000 nurses have died in the course of the U.S. pandemic so far from COVID.
All right, let's move on. We've got about just a little over 10 minutes left, but talk about developments coming out of D.C.
This week. I had wanted to go more into depth, but I don't think we'll have the time. A guy named John Sullivan has a Seattle connection. He was a fixture at BLM protests last summer and fall, before he basically got frozen out for being a suspected agent provocateur or infiltrator. It turns out the same thing has happened in five other cities that we know of, Portland, LA, Salt Lake, New York City, and DC. Well, he was filmed in the January 6th Capitol riots, leading the charge, and happened to film the Capitol policeman that shot Ashley Babbitt as she was trying to break into the House chamber. So who is he? Is he a right-wing activist? Is he an infiltrator? We don't know. Is he just an adrenaline junkie who likes showing up to protests? It turns out that his brother is, James Sullivan, is a Proud Boy who, but the thing is that when John Sullivan, filmed the shooting of Babbitt inside the Capitol, he became something of a media darling and, was latched onto by the right wing as their justification and the justification of people like Mike Solon for saying these were really Antifa. Well, yesterday, Rudy Giuliani and Kush Patel, who was the Trump loyalist and former Devin Nunes aide, who was installed as chief of staff for the acting Secretary of Defense after the election when Mark Esper was fired and another Trump loyalist, Chris Miller, was put in charge of the Pentagon. Well, the chief of staff there, Kush Patel, is tight with Rudy Giuliani and is tight with Trump. And James Sullivan, the Proud Boy, who is the brother of John Sullivan, was seen going into the White House for that meeting. And he helpfully tweeted a partial shot of the notes that he was bringing in, which appeared to be a pitch for Trump declaring martial law in his last days and blaming the January 6th insurrection on foreign paid actors, Antifa, and somehow China and and Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, was also part of this, that somehow China or Iran were responsible for this and using that as a pretext for martial law. So, you know, Trump still has 3.5 days as president to do a lot of damage. And, of course, D.C. right now is on high alert. It basically resembles the Baghdad Green Zone. Last I heard, there were over 25,000 National Guard in D.C. right now. And of course, right-wing social media has been calling for basically starting today a siege of D.C., and actions there, bring your guns, is what one flyer read last week. So a lot of places are bracing for this, including all 50 state capitals are under threat also. It's not just Olympia that's been fenced off with National Guard. Oregon has National Guard people in place in Salem. A number of state capitals are either boarded up or surrounded by local National Guard, or both. Except the Missouri House of Representatives, which closed this week, 2 days after, I forgot to mention this in the COVID update, that 2 days after they turned down a bill requiring masks in the state capitol complex, the House of Representatives had to adjourn because so many of its members now have COVID-19. This is what's happening in red states across the country. Anyway, so the state capitals are under threat too. The social media for the right wing has been saying, bring your guns. It's turning out that a number of people at the January 6th riot were armed. And, there's a question of who organized it. We've gotten a lot of play in the last couple of days on the story. First broached by Mickey Sherrill, who's a former CIA analyst, who noticed something interesting, which was on the day before the January 6th riots, on January 5th, some of the more outspoken Trump loyalists in the House of Representatives were giving tours to people who turned out to participate in the January 6th riots. These basically amounted to reconnaissance tours, and people like Mo Brooks of Alabama was involved, and some of the other Trump loyalists in the House of Representatives. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been very outspoken about saying that she didn't feel safe in the secure area, not only because Republicans there weren't wearing masks, and as I mentioned earlier, several Democratic lawmakers, including Jayapal, have gotten COVID as a result of that, but also because, she didn't trust some of the Trump loyalists in there to be giving the people rampaging through the Capitol on the phone where their location was. She didn't feel safe because of that. So there's a real question of investigating members in Congress as to whether they were complicit in the organizing of this. It turned out to be much more organized and much more populated by, active and former law enforcement and military folks. It really looks like under cover of a large rally, there was a smaller core group of people who really were intent on not only breaking into the Capitol, but trying to take lawmakers hostage and possibly execute them, which is really a kind of terrifying prospect. And it raises the question also whether people in the White House were connected to this organizing. The answer is probably yes, but there's going to have to be a lot of investigation of that coming up. The other thing that was interesting that kind of got buried in the news this week was the transfer of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin from a foreign source, ostensibly France, but it really could be anywhere, laundered through France. Two organizers of the event to cover expenses. So who was paying for the organizing of that? And why were they using cryptocurrency and laundering it into the country in a way that was less traceable? That was a Yahoo story that I'm sure has been shared with law enforcement. The FBI is trying to investigate all this and literally go through over 100,000 tips from the public as to who the participants in the riot were. They've started to arrest some of them. I think they're up to about 100 now. But that's a drop in the bucket for the number of people who broke into the Capitol. Of course, we had impeachment this week in the House of Representatives of President Bush, Trump. He became the only president to be impeached twice. The vote was 231-197. 10 Republicans voted yes, rather. Including Jamie Herrera Butler from Southwest Washington. And of course, those Republicans have been receiving a lot of death threats ever since, because apparently that's how Trump lawyers loyalist role at the moment. I really think the prospect is for an ongoing low-level violent insurgency by people loyal to Trump on the far right, an explicitly white nationalist pro-fascist movement that is going to continue to be a security threat in terms of domestic terrorism well into the Biden administration, if not in an ongoing way. This is not going to resolve this week, I don't think. Let's see, what else? So the House impeached Trump. The Senate will not be able to take up an impeachment trial until after Biden is inaugurated, because McConnell has adjourned the Senate until next Tuesday, and Biden is inaugurated on Wednesday. I don't think a whole lot in D.C. is going to happen until that does. In order to convict in the Senate at this point, the Democrats have a 50-50 majority, with a tie being broken by Kamala Harris once she is sworn in as vice president. That is the point at which McConnell will no longer be Senate majority leader. It will be Chuck Schumer. And it will be up to him to decide how to split the Senate's time between an impeachment trial and trying to take up the very urgent legislative matters that will be needed under the Biden administration in order to address particularly the pandemic and the economic downturn. An economic stimulus package, I think, will be the first order of business, that $1,400 proposal, you know, which could be amended by Congress. The Senate or an in-house, either one could amend that, and then they would have to resolve that between the two chambers. But the Democrats will control both chambers as of January 20th, once Harris becomes the tiebreaker rather than Pence in the Senate. I think that's about it in terms of what we can get to, because we're out of time. But I do want to mention that Illinois took a historic step this week in abolishing cash bail. They are the first state to do that. Criminal justice reform advocates have been advocating for that for decades, really, because it discriminates against poor people who can languish in jail for weeks or months because they can't meet bail. Instead, we have the technology now to monitor people under house detention, home detention. They don't have to languish in jail for months and months. And that's the route that Illinois is taking. So good on them, and I sure hope that's a bill that can be considered in Washington State this year or very soon.
Yeah. And then real quick, two events. Of course, we traditionally, when there isn't a pandemic, then there's a big MLK celebration here in Seattle. It's all been primarily virtual so far this week, but tomorrow there is one event, and then Sunday tomorrow there's the youth event, which will be video streamed. And by tomorrow, I mean Sunday the 17th, there'll be video streaming of the youth march event from 2:30 to 3:30. It will be streamed via Rainier Avenue Radio. And then Monday the 18th will be the traditional rally and march starting at 12 p.m. at Garfield High School. And they say you must bring your masks and wear them and social distance during the event. But
if you remember the very large BLM event last fall that had, you know, 60,000 people or something in it, they did a really good job in social distancing. So it can be done. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have a spike in local events afterwards. So as long as you social distance and wear a mask, you should be safe, and please turn out.